From the trails, woods, and waters of the Great Lakes State to the Michigan Talk Network, it's Wild Michigan with your host, Duran Martinez.
Welcome to Wild Michigan. Duran Martinez back again for another show brought to you in part by Lucky Buck Mineral. Lucky Buck Deer Mineral. Time to get it out. Lucky-buck.com. Oh, we're getting so close to antler growth season, and I love getting the Lucky Buck out. Love getting the trail camera pictures about June, July with all that growth on there. All of that new mass from using Lucky Buck Deer Mineral. Also, you can check out our website, check out our sponsors, Darton Archery, also HHA Sports, and our newest sponsor, Costa Sunglasses, making their presence known in Michigan with Wild Michigan. Very happy to have them on board, and we are very excited to be working with them this year, and we'll be talking more about that. But May is coming. The warmer weather eventually will be getting here because spring is inevitable no matter what. And that means a different type of hunting, because spring in Michigan offers so many opportunities for steelheading and turkey hunting and walleye fishing and morel mushroom hunting. And the people we go to every year without fail, like the mushrooms that come up, we go to John and Teresa Maybrier from Team Morel. Teresa Maybrier joins us on the phone right now. Hi, Teresa. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Good. Glad to have you here. You're already picking, and we're just getting ready to set our sights on it. Where are you picking right now?
Oh, around Kansas City, Missouri. It's almost over here in terms of the mushrooms are tall. We're picking 4 and 5 inch mushrooms already, and some areas on south-facing hills are already done. Anything you find there is already cooked, so...
You know,
time to start moving north, your direction.
It's time to start coming our way. You know, I talked to John earlier, your husband, and he said that you guys have a bit more of a problem with bugs on the morels than we do.
Oh, absolutely. Although I have been in Michigan up at Pigeon River Forest late in the season, like almost at Memorial Day, picking big yellows just covered in slugs. So you get them, but you don't have them for any of your black season and hardly any of your grays or half caps.
Okay. We're speaking with Teresa Maybrier from Team Morel here. Now, Teresa, one of the other things that John had made mention to me, he said he had come across some that were still, they were kind of on their way out, but
yeah,
he still takes them and hangs them so they can spore out and really kind of, you know, get that seed going for the next year.
Yeah, even if we pick up ones that are moldy, you know, like that have grown over on themselves or got stuck under a branch where they're kind of like that, or any of them that the slugs have gotten to and they're still, you know, they still have good texture to them, we always cut those off the ground and stick them up on a branch so that the spore can spread more readily through the wood.
And that's great. And if people have ever seen, my good friend Carl Glerner one time had a great big morel mushroom, and you could see these spores coming off into the sunlight. And he took a great picture of that. And that essentially is how we keep them going is, you know, there's a certain way to pick them and in the certain way to carry them, which we'll get all to here in a minute. But what is that spore? What type of ground is that spore looking to attach itself to? To grow in future generations?
You know, it can be anywhere. I mean, we've traveled and hunted in 24 states. Our lifetime goal is to hit them all, of course, but, you know, it's a little trickier the further out you have to go. But literally, they can grow up in anything. I've seen them growing out of rocks on the side of a railroad track, and I've seen them growing up through blacktop that had a major crack in it. The organism is underground, especially in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, where you have ongoing forestry. The problem with states like Iowa and Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana, we have islands of forestry. You know, we're surrounded by fields and cities and rivers and roads. So in our areas, it's even more important to carry a mesh bag and let that spore go, because we don't have that continuous woods where there's always organisms underground. You can actually wipe out an area over a five-year period. You go back to sixth year, seventh year, and you can't find any mushrooms, and you wonder why. Well, you've carried them all out of the woods in a plastic bag.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, where you guys live, yes, you still want to spread spore, and you want to carry them in a mesh bag to help keep the mushrooms fresher, but that organism has continuous space underneath all that ongoing forestry. So it's a little easier for you guys. Let me just say that.
Well, it's for us. I'm glad to hear that. Speaking with Teresa Maybrier from Team Morel, a mushroom, Morel mushroom expert here, our go-to people on the show here. You mentioned the mesh bags, and you know we've learned over the years that you have specific color bags that you like. Even though the red grapefruit bags and orange bags, things of that nature, they're cool, but because of turkey season, because we as hunters, as turkey hunters, are out at the same time mushroom hunters are out, you got to be very careful.
Well, not only that, but the problem that you have with the orange bags or the potato bags, those are all made out of plastic. And it cuts through the morels because they're hollow. They're very fragile. So the thing about using netting, you know, if you can't get a real good Team Morel collection bag, you know, go buy a couple of black smaller laundry bags like for lingerie. The black draws the heat, helps the mushrooms to dry out on the surface more, which helps spread the spore more. But they're made of cloth. They're soft, and they'll coddle the mushroom rather than building pressure on it, cutting through them. So that's the big reason to carry the fabric.
You know, it is important not only to have the spore come through the bag so they, again, kind of reseed themselves.
It also keeps them a lot fresher.
No, that too. And we're going to talk about safety, about, you know, how we need to care for them. Because, look, I'm not going to out which one of my buddies that do it, but when I hear that they get a great big grocery bag full of these things, I cringe a little bit.
Yeah, I do too, always.
You know, and there's ways to take care of them, and there's ways to clean them. What do you prescribe for drying? Because I hear soaking, and I hear rinsing, and
No. All that's bad news for them.
Give me the exact
thing is, when the scientists started growing morels, the one thing that they learned is soaking them in salt water does nothing but make them salty and deteriorate them from the cellular structure. Grandma did that because, you think about it, back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when all the Dutch elm disease came through and all those trees were dying, there was an abundance of morels. But nobody knew any science about them. Well, Grandma knew that if you brought home a bird or a fish or a bunny from the woods, you soaked it in salt water to get the gaminess out. So for her, that made sense. But we now have science to say that doesn't work for mushrooms, not any kind of mushrooms. You wouldn't go to the store and buy mushrooms and do that to them. So why would you do it to your morel? Well, you got to start using some logic. But what we teach people to do, if you do get into a season of buggy winds or you live down here like we do, chill them in the refrigerator for a couple of hours. The bugs will start to go to sleep just as if they were hibernating.
Mm-hmm.
And then only right before you're ready to cook, and only the ones you're going to cook, cut them into ringlets separating caps and stems. Give them a good washing in the colander and pat them dry. Start cooking with the stems first because they're a different texture, a firmer texture, fabulous taste. But you want to cook those about 3 minutes longer than the caps, which are more fragile, and because of the convoluted shaping of them, they'll cook up quicker. And as soon as they start popping like bacon, you know they're done. But if you're a batter fryer and you want to have, you know, like a deep fry,
mm-hmm.
you'll actually see the mushrooms shimmy in the oil. And I don't know if they're releasing moisture or if it's air, but they'll do a little shimmy in the water or in the oil when they're done cooking.
All right, Teresa Maybrier is our guest. We're going to talk more about morels. The season is coming forth, and you're listening to us here. It's Wild Michigan on the Michigan Talk Network.
Down the road, I still believe.
Hey, Michiganiacs, this is your blood brother Ted Nugent celebrating the almighty Michigan Spirit of the Wild with my blood brother Duran Martinez on Wild Michigan. Go Wild.
Welcome back to Wild Michigan. I'm Duran Martinez, your host, all over the world at wildmichiganradio.com. So glad to have you here, man. So glad to have a new sponsor, Costa Sunglasses, on board with us here. And a fun show today. Fun show all wrapped up here. We're talking about walleye fishing. We're talking about mushroom hunting, talking about ticks, talking a little bit about hunter safety, and you know, even mushroom safety. The reason we get Teresa today, because we had spoke with John, her husband, but there are some dangers, Teresa, to mushroom hunting, and you have found that out firsthand. And I guess, I don't know if it's fair of me to share this, but...
Oh, it's fine.
But there's some safety that, you don't think about.
Oh, I think about it. I have a Western cap, a hat that's very hard. You know, it's like wax canvas, very sturdy. I wear glasses, so I always wear protection. And yet, I got caught. I bent over, pushed some brush out of my way, and an underneath branch that I didn't see come up and pop me in the eye. And I might be out for the season. I look like a boxer. It's just terrible.
And see, wow, and that's tough for somebody that likes doing what you do, and you need your eyes.
Well, and the other thing I tell people about the woods, because this happened to me as a kid, I grew up in central Iowa, and there are a lot of hawthorns. And I stepped on a hawthorn in tennis shoes. So I tell people all the time, wear boots to the woods. Tennis shoes are not designed for the woods.
Exactly. Teresa Maybrier from Team Morel is joining me right now. Teresa, real quickly, how can we find you? I know we found your Facebook page for Team Morel. Are there other ways we can find you as well?
Well, you can go to Barnes & Noble or at Amazon and pick up our book. We're also in the national parks now in areas that have Morels. Team Morel, the book is called Morel Hunting by John and Teresa Maybrier, and it's based on my 40 years of field knowledge wrapped up with Larry Lonick's science knowledge when he grew morels for Domino's Pizza in Michigan.
Really?
Yeah.
How interesting is that?
I met him in the late 90s, and he told me that they were looking for a grant to see if what they learned in science matched up with the woods. And I said, well, what do you need to know? And he told me, you know, what they were interested in. And I said, well, I have about 25 years of records. He goes, what the hell for? And I said, well, because I'm crazy that way. I keep journals on everything I'm interested in, you know, just out of curiosity. And I said, when I moved from Iowa to Missouri my first year to go to college, I couldn't find any morels. And what I learned was that they start in the south and work their way north about 100 miles a week. So I had just missed them. And I kept records every year after that. Well, it was like a wonderful aha moment for both of us, because he had the two things from science that I needed to make my records make sense. And as soon as he told me those two things, my gosh, we went through my records and it was just over and over again backing up what they learned in science. And those two things were that the spores are drawn out by the mushrooms drying out. The air actually goes into those pockets and pulls the spore out. And that's what makes more mushrooms. And that they're basically a five-year cycle from the time those spore hit the ground to make a new mushroom. Now, it's trumped by things like traumas, forest fires, cut trees, trees dying. Those make our big batches because that gives the underground organism energy to reproduce. But the other part of it is, you know, you'll find those onesies out in the woods. That's where the spore is developed, and there's nothing really there to support it. And you'll just find one, and then it'll just go away. So there was that. So it's between the spore and the cycles. Well, people think, you know, hey, I'll just go where I was last year and find them. And they're not usually there the next year. Because once a tree root material has died far enough, then the fungus of the morel no longer feeds on that, and it moves to other parts of the woods. So you can go back to the same woods, just not necessarily the same trees. They're feeding off that root material.
Sure. Teresa May Brier is our guest here from Team Morrell. Teresa, let's talk about briefly about cutting. You have a way that you feel is proper and right to cut, and it ensures more growth throughout the cycle.
That's right. You know, if you cut, number one, it's faster. It's cleaner because you're not bringing up any of the dirt. And if you are an early mushroom hunter and you cut an area, you can go back a week later if the weather conditions don't change dramatically, and you'll find another batch has come up off of that, not that hole, not the stem that you cut, but very near it, because the underground organism is trying to reproduce, and it has a short window to do that. The little shoot up, maybe smaller ones, but you can get a second batch right where you were.
See, and that helps because you can go back to your spot and you know, it really kind of double your pleasure, so to speak.
Absolutely.
And what are you using to cut? Because that also is important.
Well, John just bought me a beautiful, beautiful custom-made knife, you know, because we're crazy about this and do it all the time. But you can use something as simple as a picnic knife. And if you're taking kids along, that little serrated edge is just fine. They're hollow. They're not hard to cut off.
Now, let's talk about false morels, because we know there are morels. That is morels a one-piece mushroom, correct?
Correct.
And the false morel, please describe that if you would.
Well, there's actually two varieties that people call false morels. Mm-hmm. But anything that's not a morel is a false morel. So I'd like to slug the person that started this whole thing.
Okay, that's fair.
But in the springtime, both verpas and geometras are out there. The verpas are edible, but on a small scale, because they have a muscle relaxant in it. But if you like that drunken feeling, you can have some, and it's not so bad. But if you eat a whole bunch, your heart is a muscle, you can go in coma. And they look a lot like the half-cap morel. They are long-stemmed, short-topped. The difference is that if you cut them open, the morel is completely hollow, and even though that cap hangs partly free, it is part of the stem. On the verpa, that cap will separate from the stem completely. It just sits on top of it, and inside the stem is a white cottony material. And most people don't eat the stems because that white cottony material is fairly nasty tasting. So you can eat a few if you get some by accident or eat them. They're probably pretty harmless. But the ones that can harm you are the geometra family, the beefsteaks. And I think the reason people get all excited about beefsteaks is they're larger, they're meatier, they look brain-like or flappy. The saying is, if they're red, you could be dead.
Mm-hmm.
They don't affect everybody, but I've talked to lots of people when I've been on the road doing the sports shows that get immediately sick and have to be hospitalized. The problem with them is that they have learned over time the monomethylhydrazine that is in them, which is only a degree off of jet fuel, is so strong it lingers in your liver and it builds up. So, you know, you might eat them your whole life, and your whole life ends when you eat the next one.
Sure.
And you die. You know, so like in your mid-50s, late-60s, if you've eaten them your whole life, you reach that spillover point, it will make you very, very sick. It dissolves your liver, and there's nothing they can do for you.
All right, Teresa May Brier.
So it's just best to leave them alone.
Appreciate you joining us here. It's Team Morrell on Wild Michigan.
You can join us on Facebook or listen to podcasts, all from our website at wildmichiganradio.com. Now, back to Duran Martinez and Wild Michigan.
Cross the line at an hour to time. In a state 94 more miles through the Great Lakes State. Turn it up so the bus ain't late. Another night in Michigan.
Welcome back to Wild Michigan. I'm Duran Martinez. That song, that very song, was the lead-in to the segment that we heard on the way up north. My girlfriend Sarah Marie and I took a last-minute trip up to the UP just to go. And with that song by Hello Dave, in with the Mackinac Bridge in view was absolutely amazing. Reminds me of how much I love this state and how much it's snow and ice is still on some of the lakes, on Burt, on Mullet, on Higgins Lake when we went last week, how so much ice was still flowing through the straits up north, man. It's still cold out there, but we have the promise. We have the promise of some warmer weather here in springtime. Going to speak with our friend Chad Pipkins right now. Chad, of course, is a pro angler on the BASS Elite Series and was out at the Bassmaster Classic when we met him for the first time. Chad from Holt actually lives very close to me, and he is now on the road to California. Chad, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Good. Now, what's the tournament you got going on out in California?
We've got our West Coast Swing with the Bassmaster Elite Series. So it's been about, I think, 5 years since they went west, and we're heading out to the California Delta, and we're going to follow it up with Lake Havasu in Arizona.
Lake Havasu, that's going to be a very cool trip. Now, we know
it's going to be a very hot trip,
Cool,
very hot.
Okay, well, there's that, but SPF like 100, and keep your arms and keep your arms covered and wear a hat. So
exactly.
There's my my tips for you, the pro angler, because you need them.
All tips help.
Right. Now, you're going to be fishing against Skeet Reese, who just came off a big win here recently as well, and that's his territory.
It is. I think there's about 7 or 8 guys that are from out west, so it'll be a little different experience. I went out west in the fall and tried to kind of scout a little bit, but that was when California kind of ended their drought a little bit. I helped fuel that fire, so it didn't get a lot done out there, but got to look around at Havasu for a couple of days and look around at the Delta, so I'm excited to get out here and get to work.
Now, as a pro angler on the Elite Series, there are a lot of misnomers, a lot of misinformation out there. You, sir, are driving your own boat out to California.
Yeah, don't you fly? I'm like, well, a boat is an expensive carry-on, so yes, I got to drive. Actually got a passenger for the first time. I got my dad cruising out here with me, so please get some help driving this time.
Well, good. Now, what are the lakes in California you're going to be fishing out there?
We're fishing the California Delta, and then we're fishing the Lake Havasu in Arizona. So the Delta is just a big, there's a couple rivers that come through there, and then it's a lot of man-made canals and just a lot of vegetation. So it's a really, really unique fishery. There's some absolute giant bass out there. And it's also a tidal fishery, so it's going to be a pretty tricky place, but should be some really big waves and some huge, huge fish. So I'm looking forward to getting out there. And then Havasu in Arizona is like a desert lake. It's really, really pretty lake. It's got a lot of like little cliff desert rocks and then some sandy stuff. It's very unique looking. Clean water. It's got a lot of smallmouth and largemouth. It should be fun to get over there too.
Speak with Chad Pipkins here on Wild Michigan. Of course, he is part of the BASS Elite Series, sponsored by a local company, Douglas J. Salons. And I'm sure we've mentioned this before, you get a lot of attention being a guy with that sponsor.
Yeah, you got to have a niche. I mean, it's so hard to make it in our industry just because our expenses are so high. You know, when you first start off, and it's good to be a little different, and I never really liked wearing a hat on stage, and the Douglas J thing was kind of a great fit. You know, we do a lot of fun stuff for good charities and good causes, but it's a good fit, and it helps give me a little extra press, which never hurts anything.
No, absolutely not. Now, tell me, what is going to be your attack plan? You're going to have hot temperatures above the water. The water temps are probably still going to be up there as well, but is this, give me a little bit of info on your approach to hot weather bass like that.
Yeah, it's going to be a little different from Havasu to the Delta. I mean, the Delta, it's still Northern California, so their average temps are like low 70s right now. So the majority of the fish probably have spawned in the last month. So there'll be some mostly post-spawn fish, but there'll still be some fish on bed. So when I come into this, I'm going to look for numbers of quality fish. I mean, if the majority of the fish are post-spawn, those are the fish I'm going to be targeting. So instead of getting like in the back of dead-end pockets, you know, with clean water where there's less current flow, you know, those are areas where maybe the spawners and pre-spawners will be at. Maybe on the way out, there's going to be some points in some places to target fish that are starting to feed back up. A lot of times, fish during post-spawn, they kind of scatter out a little bit. So that tide's going to play a big role. I mean, if you get, like, the last part of an outgoing tide, and you can get on the outside edges of some grass, those fish are fun to eat. So it could be a situation where you just kind of pull up on the right little grassy turn or bend in the river, and you could load the boat. That's what I plan on looking for.
All right, Chad Pipkins is our guest here. He's making his way out to California with the Bassmaster Elite Series. Let's talk about Havasu. That Arizona is hot, 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 dry heat, but still your upper water temperature is still going to be pretty hot. Are these fish going to run deep, or are you going to find them in some shady pockets?
Yeah, that's going to be a totally different fishery than the Delta. I mean, like I said, average temp at the Delta, air temp is like 73 right now. It's already almost 90. And Havasu. So those fish have spawned a couple months ago. I mean, you might find a couple stragglers, but the majority of the fish are still going to be caught. I would say there's like a transition line where you lose visibility in like 8 to 10 feet. And I think a lot of those fish might not be out all the way deep yet, but are going to be in those outer drop-offs and still points, rocky banks, maybe some bluffs. There's a lot of man-made structure at Havasu. You know, it's such a desert-like lake. There wasn't a lot of grass before. There wasn't a lot of wood or trees or anything like that, fish habitat. So their DNR there, their fish people over there, they did some work, and they put in a lot of, like, they're called, like, fish houses. They've got things made out of tires, things made out of PVC pipe, and it's just some of the pockets and bays are literally littered with them along the bottom, and they range from, 4 feet down to 15 feet, and those habitats are going to play a huge role. And, it's about finding the right depths in which the fish are using those habitats.
Speak with Chad Pipkins here on Wild Michigan. Chad, we just enacted 2 weeks ago, I think it was. We are able to target bass for catch and immediate release purposes outside of the season. And that's going to be pretty exciting. So did you, while you were home for a couple of weeks, even get the boat wet here in Michigan now that we have that ability to target bass?
No, I didn't. Unfortunately, I had to come home and work a little bit. Like I said, the expenses are pretty high starting off, so I still run a small paint company when I'm at home. But it's a great season change for us in Michigan. I mean, we've got a lot of unbelievable fisheries. And it's nice to know that if you get that itch and it's warm in April, you can get out in the water and not have to worry about targeting bass. I mean, the majority of us out there, we're out there to have fun, and we enjoy the species, the sport, and we want to preserve that. So, we're not looking out there to bring home a bunch of fish fillets and stuff. Not that that's wrong once in a while. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's good to know that you can get out and have a good time and target bass early on and just get out and have some fun.
I agree. It looks like, we're just, we have yet another season to look forward to, protecting the resource, but still being able to target, intentionally what type of species we like to catch. I mean, pre-spawn bass are a blast to catch, and the immediate release, that really protects them. But again, to have that ability, you gotta love it. Real quickly, about 30 seconds left in the segment, we have just brought Costa Sunglasses on board with us. Very happy to have them on as a sponsor of Wild Michigan, and they're one of your sponsors as well.
Yeah, I've been with Costa since I started my career, and there was no other choice. When I first started, I might have got a few percent off the glasses, but the bottom line is that I wanted the glasses. If you put a pair on, the slogan is Costa, see what's out there. And it's no joke. You put that pair of sunglasses on and you put something else on, it looks like you're looking through prescription lens. If you look at a tree with colors on it, you can see every little outline. It's pretty awesome stuff.
No, we're looking forward to working with them. We just put our order in. We are headed over to Ireland to do some fly fishing for pike and wild trout. Going to be taking Costa with us, and we're very excited about that, and very glad to know that you're on board with them as well, because it gives us another talking point here on the show.
Definitely. Now, if you get a chance, we're giving away a couple pairs of Costa glasses at MakeWaterMatter.com or at my website, ChadPipkins.com. We got a great fundraiser. We're giving away a couple pair of Costa glasses. Check it out.
All right. Check him out. Chad Pipkins. Find all the links on our website, WildMichiganRadio.com, on the Michigan Talk Network.
Well, I'm going down to the swamp. Going to watch me have a lot of chickens.
Send your suggestions, comments, or questions to us here via email at outdoormailbag@gmail.com. Now, back to Wild Michigan with your host, Duran Martinez.
Welcome back to Wild Michigan. I'm Duran Martinez. all over the Great Lakes State on the Michigan Talk Network. Our website, wildmichiganradio.com. And we like to try and stay ahead of the game. Of course, things are warming up outside. Despite the cold front we've had come through, we are going to be outdoors. We are going to be hunting. We're going to be fishing. And what we need to be aware of are the things that could make our life difficult, uncomfortable, or make us sick. We got some reports that southern lower Michigan will be experiencing some higher than normal tick rates this year. So we've contacted Eric Foster, the entomologist for the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, to join us on the show to do a little tick talk, if you will. And Eric, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joanne.
Good to have you along. So what is prompting this alarm almost that we're having a larger than normal amount of ticks in southern lower Michigan this year?
Yeah, I think the alarm is coming from the fact that we now have a species here in Michigan that can transmit several different diseases to people, and that over time, having the appropriate type of habitats in Michigan, some really great forested habitats, and a lot of hosts for these ticks, which normally feed on wildlife like deer and rodents, these populations are increasing over time.
Now, what people may not know about ticks, we learned from our good friend Dr. George a number of years ago, is the reason we don't feel a tick bite initially is they have a chemical, or I can't remember the exact name of what it is, but it really kind of, allows them to go in unnoticed.
Right. Yeah. It's like a desensitizing agent and an antihistamine. So normally, if you think about when you get bit by a mosquito or some other bug like that, your body is reacting to that the chemical that they're desensitizing you with, and it's a histamine reaction that you get. So they're really good at it, and not normally until that tick drops off of your body will you feel that there was actually a tick there.
Now, here's the question I have. I've been woke up a couple of years ago. We were up in the UP. We were fishing in some tall grass. We had come out and, let's check. Let's check for ticks. And my good friend Russ Bartell pulls off his shirt. He had four of them, and they were moving around. Of course, it looked like a hat dance all of a sudden.
Right.
Trying to kill these things. So he's been named the tick magnet. And then I woke up to one crawling up the back of my neck, which, believe me, will give you the Wilbers out of a dead sleep. But
no doubt.
So what are they, how are they attaching themselves to us? In what types of areas are they hiding?
Yeah, so normally they're gonna get onto our bodies, normally down lower to the ground. These creatures are looking for hosts. They're not really looking to get on people. They're normally a forest creature, so they want to get on a small mammal or a deer, depending on the stage of the tick. And so they're normally going to get on our legs, and from there they're going to try and crawl up and find some skin to get on. They tend to go into areas like the nape of the neck and the hairline. Could be behind the ear, armpits, behind the knee, and in the waistline and groin areas, pretty much where they like to go. They don't want to be detected. They're pretty good at hiding and doing what they do.
So are there ways, we know like tall boots, tucking our pant legs in, collared or long sleeve shirts, things of that nature, but they're still going to get in there too.
Yeah, there are actually a couple different ways that you could approach it. As an aside, a buddy of mine was asking me to go turkey hunting with him in a couple weeks, and actually next week. And I was thinking to myself, I've got all my gear, I've got my clothing, everything's looking good, but I'm going to be sitting down a lot against maybe a tree or something like that. And I was thinking to myself, wow, the ticks, I need to do something about that, because you're right. They can crawl up, they can get inside your pants, they can get inside your shirts. They're small and hard to detect. So there are clothing repellents out there right now. So there are some companies that pre-treat their clothing. They're factory treated with a chemical called permethrin, and they are repellent to ticks. And when the ticks get onto the clothing, they'll either drop off or they'll die. The U.S. military also uses these. The Army pre-treats their uniforms using this same technology, and it works really, really well. You can also get aftermarket treatments at outdoor stores, hunting and fishing stores, that you spray onto the clothing. You let it dry, and it's good through several washings. And it really, really works great.
You know, if you're going to spend a lot of time outdoors, that's definitely the way to go. I mean, look, what's your health worth? You know, what's your the risk of getting Lyme's disease or the like, even other types of tick-borne illnesses? A little extra money, a little extra prevention does not hurt. Eric Foster, entomologist for the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, joins us here on Wild Michigan on the Michigan Talk Network. We know the bullseye. The red ring from a tick bite is one of the early sites of Lyme's disease. But what else can we see when it comes to, you know, if we've been bitten?
Right. Yeah. About 60-70% of people are going to have that bullseye ring, and you may not even remember if you were bitten by a tick. Most of the time, when people are getting Lyme disease in the United States and in the Upper Midwest, it's because of the nymphal ticks, and these ticks are very small. They're about the size of a poppy seed initially. And then they will attach for a few days, and they will engorge. So oftentimes people aren't seeing them, especially if you've got longer hair or something like that. So you may see the rash, but some people don't have the rash. So other things to look for in the summer, after you've been, you know, recreating or working in the woods where there may be ticks, you're looking for chills and fever, looking for headaches, muscle and joint pain, fatigue, these types of things. It's kind of akin to a pretty nasty flu-like illness without the respiratory symptoms.
Now, we have several different types of ticks here in Michigan. What is the one that's probably most prevalent and the one we may be most prone to disease from?
Okay, well, that's going to be two answers then. The one that's most prevalent is the American dog tick. It's very common pretty much across all of Michigan. They are out right now. They're big and brown colored, have some white markings on them. They're also commonly called wood ticks. And they're pretty easy to spot. Only the adults really are the ones that are going to bite us here in Michigan, and they're going to be around from now until late June, early July, and then they drop off. The other species that we worry about the most is the black-legged tick, or what used to be called the deer tick. And these are very common in the western Upper Peninsula. We've known they were there since the mid-80s. But these are the ones that have been emerging in southern Michigan since the early 2000s. And this is the tick that carries Lyme disease. And it's a smaller tick, tend to be more black in color. They have black legs, as the name implies. And right now, the adult ticks are out. And the female ticks of this species will have black legs and a little black round shield near the head. Head and a red abdomen. They're pretty strikingly different than the look of a wood tick. They're much smaller, different color, and these are the ticks that transmit Lyme disease, and there are several other diseases that are emerging from this tick.
You know, I'm looking, speaking with Eric Foster from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, I'm looking at a list of some of the big name things, aside from Lyme disease. Boy, that's the easy one to say.
Right.
But I'm looking at some of the other diseases that can happen, and it can be kind of nasty.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, one of the good things, if there is a silver lining in this, is that a couple of these things can be treated by the same treatment. So Lyme disease is very treatable. If you catch it early, if you're aware of, you know, your general health, and you go to see your physician as soon as any types of symptoms would occur, you get treated with antibiotics, and those antibiotics may knock out several different things that it could be. The other diseases associated with this tick are one called anaplasmosis. This would be treated with the same drug. There's another one that's kind of like a malaria illness called babesia, which we haven't seen in Michigan yet, but is emerging in the Upper Midwest. Wisconsin and Minnesota have a lot of these ticks and a lot more cases of disease than we do. And so we in Michigan are considered an emerging state for these types of tick-borne diseases because the ticks haven't been established that long. As time goes on, we expect that these cases will rise. There's not a whole lot that we can do about that. It's hard to treat for ticks in the forest and things like that. We can do our personal prevention, But over time, it's just something that we're going to have to be become educated about and aware of and practice our prevention methods.
And again, just about 30 seconds left here. Easy prevention. You know, turkey hunting, it doesn't matter what you smell like, which is great. So you can use something with 20 to 30% DEET, and that'll give you a good upper hand on these things.
Yep, absolutely.
So Eric Foster, I really appreciate you joining us, entomologist for the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. Have a good bug-free weekend, sir.
You too.
Appreciate it. Oh, so much information, so little time. Appreciate everybody joining us here on Wild Michigan. Again, our website, wildmichiganradio.com. Thanks to Lucky Buck, Deer Mineral, HHA Sports, Darton Archery, and Costa Sunglasses. If you missed any of this show, pick it up on the podcast at wildmichiganradio.com. Have a great weekend. Get out, do some fishing, do some hunting, but take the kids with you. They're the future of outdoor sports.